From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit us at stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Progressive Christianity actually has a history that goes back over 100 years.
We've reached a point in our history where Christianity, if it's going to survive, has got to transcend the boundaries of religion.
We have to respond to social challenges as interconnected with one another and joined together as part of one movement for justice and change.
There is an ongoing soul-searching among many progressive people of faith. As much as many of the most important steps forward in decade after decade originated with, or at least benefited from, widespread support from progressive religion, in recent years, the loudest religious voices in our public discourse have been relentlessly conservative. That's not to say that important economic and social justice initiatives do not continue to benefit from progressive people of faith. Here on this show, we regularly highlight these kinds of stories, and the Nuns on the Bus initiative was a rare instance of one such initiative making a widespread dash of headlines. But overall, I think it's fair to say that this is a time for renewal and rebirth, and a lot of thinking about that is going on. Now, what that process looks like and what the future of the movement needs to be are both an important and a fascinating set of topics. This week, I'll be talking about it with Dr. Catherine Henderson, president of Auburn Theological Seminary, a driving force behind a number of explorations of the future potential of progressive faith in action.
Pope Francis has ordered bishops to do some survey work to find out what the faithful really think about its teachings on marriage and family.
You might need to go back to the Middle Ages for the question, did you hear what the Pope said, to be on as many lips as it is today. In his short tenure as the leader of the Roman Catholic Church, Pope Francis has provoked some, inspired others, and sparked a global conversation on what the role of the church is in the world today and what it should be. Not uncharacteristically, the Pope has gone beyond encouraging conversations to inviting dialogue with the people in the pews. And stepping up to facilitate that process is the organization Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good. They posted an online narrative survey with the promise to deliver the responses to the Vatican, and in the first couple of days, they had already received thousands of comments and stories. On this week's show, we'll get a preliminary look at this unusual survey from CACG Senior Fellow Christopher Hale. But first,
critics argue it's unconstitutional and makes it seem like the government is endorsing religion. Now, supporters of the practice say that this is just another attempt to strip religion out of American life.
This past Wednesday, the Supreme Court heard arguments in what could be an important case in the area of church-state separation. The case is known as Town of Greece versus Galloway, with the Alliance Defending Freedom notorious for frequent attempts to invoke the religious liberty argument to defend bias and a strictly conservative Christian viewpoint through the courts, representing the suburban upstate community in an appeal to a lower court ruling. The plaintiffs are represented by Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. It's really a high-profile case, the first time the High Court has taken a legislative prayer case since the seminal Marsh versus Chambers ruling all the way back in 1983. Interfaith Alliance Deputy Director for Public Policy, Ariel Gingold, stayed up all night to join the throngs inside the courtroom so that immediately after hearing oral arguments, she could come and talk with us about what happened in that room. Ariel, welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks for having me again.
So what time did you go to the court?
My colleagues and I got there around 3:45 in the morning, and believe it or not, I was number 17 in line. I was nowhere near the first one there.
How did it start? Did you hear anything to suggest the direction the justices may take on this case?
The attorney for the town, maybe less than 30 seconds into his beginning of his argument, Justice Kagan jumped in right away and posed a hypothetical that would carry throughout the rest of the time that the attorneys were arguing the case, which is to say, would it be constitutional if we began this session today with having a Christian member of the clergy stand up and then Justice Kagan read through one of the actual prayers that was given before the legislative session in the town of Greece that was wholly sectarian. The person who delivered the prayer, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, who died on the cross for my sins, etc. Mm-hmm. And Justice Kagan asked, would that be constitutional? And the attorney, I believe, pretty quickly said no, and then walked that back a little bit later by saying we're talking about different contexts here. Uh-huh. To your second question, it's hard to get a read on them, particularly, I think, on church-state issues. And, you know, I think that there were some positive signs. I think there were some signs for concern for our side of things. And I would not presume to try to predict which way it will go.
You know, Ariella, our listeners may not be familiar with what the specifics of the case are. So why don't you also address that?
Sure. The case concerns whether it is constitutional for the town of Greece to open their legislative bodies sessions. More broadly, it may go to whether government bodies in general mm-hmm. can open official business with prayer. And there are a couple of different levels of this. We joined a brief that was authored expertly by our colleagues at the ACLU that was also joined by the Anti-Defamation League. And in that brief, we argue that in all contexts, government-sponsored, government-led prayer is unconstitutional. But if the court is not willing to go that far, if they're not willing to overturn the case you mentioned, Marsh v. Chambers, the bare minimum standard should be that sectarian prayer, prayer that is specific to one particular religion, particular to one denomination within a religion, is unconstitutional. In the context of Greece, the prayers were delivered exclusively by Christian clergy for years upon years. And then once that practice was challenged and the suit was filed, I believe they brought in one person of a non-Christian faith, maybe one a year for a few years. These prayers happen once a month. So one non-Christian in a year of 11 Christians doesn't quite make for diversity.
Mm-hmm. Those of us who are concerned about religious freedom look at this as a very important case. Some people say, well, what difference does it make whether they do that or not, whether they pray or not? Talk about that a minute so people understand what's going on.
Part of the issue here isn't even the religion of the prayer giver. There's one separate issue that everybody who delivered the prayers in Greece was almost entirely a Christian clergy member. Mm-hmm. The next issue, sort of on top of that, a lot of the prayers were not non-denominational. Those people delivering the prayers made them very specific to Christianity as opposed to making it more general for other people of faith to really partake in as well. Justice Kagan, I believe it was, made the point that a lot of times the court's opinions on religious liberty cases are taken as anti-religion, but it's in the best interest of our nation for the government and religion to stay separate so that we can have a multi-faith society. And that's absolutely true. This is about prohibiting entanglement between religion and government that weakens both. Mm-hmm. The additional layer here is that we're talking about people who are going to their government to petition their government for whatever it may be. In the context of this case, one of the plaintiffs was going to her local government to petition them about an issue with local public access programming on television. They weren't just sitting in the Senate gallery observing what the body below was doing. They were there to ask for something, petition the government for a redress of an issue. And before being able to do that, were asked to stand or to bow their heads or to otherwise solemnize a type of prayer or prayer in general that they may not agree with. And what impact does that have on them and their actions, mm-hmm. as well as on their case? And by that, I mean, will they then feel coerced? And we believe that this is a real issue, that people will feel coerced to participate in prayer in order to put themselves in a better position to receive a good result from the government. Yeah. I believe it was Doug Laycock who argued the case for Americans United, made the point that no good lawyer would counsel their clients not to stand for a prayer if not standing would put them in a worse off position and make it look like they're not being respectful of the will of the body. So there is a real issue of coercion on real people who are going to the government to get their needs met.
So, Ariel, if the court rules against prayer, then we understand there'll be no prayers. But what if the court rules that sectarian prayer is illegal, but prayer generally is okay? Doesn't that leave the government defining prayer?
It does in some ways, and that was actually something that troubled a number of the justices. I remember Justice Sotomayor raising that issue several times. Part of me is inclined to say that it's sort of like a you know it when you see it. If a prayer mentions Jesus Christ or a particular prophet or name of God for another faith, it's generally safe to say that that is sectarian. The other issue in this case is not just is it sectarian, but is it proselytizing? Is it advancing a particular religion? And so there are definitely ways in which we could be inviting the government to get even more entangled. On a base level, saying at least sectarian prayer is bad sets up local government to at least advise clergy in a way that may prevent that from happening. Right now, the town of Greece does not give clergy any guidelines. Mm-hmm. This was another concern raised by the justices. Well, isn't it a violation of religious liberty for government to tell clergy coming to pray in the legislative body how to pray and what they can and cannot do?
I know it's not the Supreme Court's business to define prayer, but I would like to say, in defense of someone who prays and thinks that people ought to be able to pray, that I don't want the government defining prayer, and it's better if we don't have the prayer in the council room or whatever, because this debate itself ignores the basic definition of prayer, which is a personal communion with a higher power. Mm-hmm. Some call God, some call Abba, some, you know, whatever. Regardless of how the court rules on this, what should Americans care about as they follow what the Supreme Court does with this?
One of the things that really stuck with me this morning was something that Justice Kagan said, and I think it speaks to a lot of the perspective that Interfaith Alliance holds on these issues as well, and I found it very compelling. She noted that our religious liberty means that we are all equal under the law, and I'm paraphrasing. And when we relate to government, we all do so as Americans, not as Jews, not as Christians, not as Muslims. And so if our religious liberty means that we are all equal under the law, then it is incongruous with that to say that when we show up to talk to government and to interact with government, we have to start by identifying ourselves in any other way than I am an American, mm-hmm. and that we'd have to identify ourselves religiously in some way. Yeah. And I think that's a really key issue here.
It's a good point. Ariel Gingold is Deputy Director of Public Policy at Interfaith Alliance. She does remarkable work, and I appreciate her coming in to tape this interview on Wednesday after fighting her way into the Supreme Court building early this morning. Ariel, thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio. Go to bed.
Thank you, Elton.
Later in the show, Christopher Hale of Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good. They're gathering public comments and stories that they will forward to the Vatican. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. The Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson is president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, a profoundly influential center of faith-based leadership, activism, and innovative ministry. As the seminary slogan urges, the mission is to trouble the waters and heal the world. This past summer, I was privileged to attend a summit of progressive faith leaders in Tennessee, spearheaded by Auburn. Our purpose was intense analysis and strategy for what's next in the religious progressive movement. I've been really eager to have a follow-up conversation with Dr. Henderson. We talked with her on State of Belief while we were in Nashville, and I'm very pleased now today that we can have an opportunity to follow up on that conversation. I want to thank Catherine and her staff at Auburn, and particularly Mackie Alston with her, for being such good friends to State of Belief Radio. We work hand in hand together, and for so many reasons. Catherine, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Welton, it's great to be back with you, and thank you for those kind words. We appreciate the relationship and the role that State of Belief plays in the movement.
You know, any time the subject turns to the role of progressive religion in public life, the first reality that always intrudes is the way the language of morality, religious freedom, and faith-based activism has become so aligned in the media with conservative Christianity. Mm-hmm. Does that matter?
In some ways, it doesn't really matter, because I think that what some of us are seeing is a growing and vibrant and very much alive, what I would call a multi-faith movement for justice, that is growing across the country, you know, where there are groups, large and small, bright spots, really, of diverse people of faith and moral courage who are, you know, taking to the streets, taking to the voting booths, taking to the internet to enact values that often come from a faith place, about how we create a society where there's human flourishing for all, with an emphasis on all.
Yes.
You know, all
yes.
of God's children.
I often wonder, how important is it for us to tell people who we are as people in progressive religion, or if it's not better just to show them?
I think there's obviously room for both.
Sure.
There's the telling, but obviously putting things into action and living the good life is really what we're about. And I think that's what our religious teachings tell us. I mean, from my Christian perspective and yours, the text that I often go back to is Matthew 25. If you see me hungry, feed me. If you see me unclothed, clothe me. Visit me in prison when I'm in prison. If I'm a stranger, invite me in. And so, you know, a text like that is about right action, right relationship, and then right policies, we might say.
Sure.
And so it certainly can be about words, and words can be inspiring, and words matter a lot as we create a culture of civility and compassion. But actions, yes, they do often speak louder than words.
As you muse on our mission and our narrative, what come to mind as some of the major obstacles to what we're trying to do?
I think that an obstacle that I see is actually money.
Mm-hmm.
I worry a lot about money, because you need money to create infrastructures that support movements for justice. And we have certainly seen conservatives underwrite a movement,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of money for media, for education, for leadership training. And I think that those of us who are a part of building multi-faith movements for justice really need to underwrite our movements in a much more robust way. And we often see, for example, I was in a church just recently and was doing a tour of a newly renovated homeless shelter, and that was wonderful. It's very important for people to have beds to sleep at night, but that doesn't really address the systemic issues of poverty and the creation of the need for those beds, namely homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we need to do a reframe from, you know, charity and benevolence giving through congregations and individuals, and really try to get at building an infrastructure that's going to change systems.
You know, I am so glad you said that, because we've talked about it before, of course, but I really do believe you're right on target. The community of more conservative Christians and more fundamentalist Christians seems to understand the necessity of financing nonprofits within their realm of ideology, and they do that with a level of devotion and generosity that I don't think is duplicated in our movement.
I think that we definitely have room to grow in this area, and yes, funding robustly and funding over a long enough period of time to actually change the game. And I am seeing, actually, that there is a change here. There are people that we are running into who may have grown up in the church and have very fond feelings but may not be associated with organized religion, and their philanthropy has of late been really focused on politics, on political philanthropy. But some of them are now actually seeing that faith-based organizing is the lever for social change. It's the key ingredient. And some of them are starting to think about strategic philanthropy in a different way.
Yeah. Going beyond that, I want to just acknowledge that there are a few prominent voices who challenge the very premise of a progressive faith-based movement. What do you say to those people?
If I read the signs of the times correctly, I'm seeing a very robust faith-based movement that's growing in many different places. For example, one of the signs is the Moral Mondays movement that started last April in North Carolina, where, you know, William Barber, head of the NAACP and also a pastor, is leading the way. And, you know, the Moral Mondays movement is happening in some ways across the country and pockets. We have a growing group here in New York City that I've been associated with. I think of Sister Simone Campbell and the Nuns on the Bus, who have brought the issue of a moral budget to bear and also focus now on immigration issues. And I also, quite frankly, let's talk about Pope Francis.
Oh, my.
I think that he may be a sign of the time, too, somebody who's trying to reframe the perspectives and interpretation of tradition and action, getting back to that action piece for the Catholic Church, but also for many of us who are watching his actions and listening very carefully to his words. I think about LGBT equality and faith leaders all across the country who are standing for it and not against it. So for those who would say that there is not a faith-based movement for justice, I would dispute that.
Well, I want you to not be too modest and not mention what's going on at Auburn as well, because Groundswell is a part of this movement, as are other items. So I'd like you to mention some of what's there.
Sure, absolutely. One of the ways that people organize and move is through the Internet now. And so we are developing an online community through Groundswell, which is our site for online organizing. Auburn's mission is to equip leaders to do the work of justice and to build communities and bridge divides. And so Groundswell is our site for digital organizing, where we help to equip leaders, train them how to do digital organizing, how they can show up on the Internet and gather force around social issues. And some of the ones that have been most robust have been around human trafficking, around gun violence, and marriage equality. So it's a tool. It's a tool for the leaders, and it's a very effective. We have an online community now of around 100,000 people all across the country, which is
amazing.
Very exciting. And then we were very fortunate with others to come together in Nashville in June. You mentioned this earlier, under the rubric of Mountaintop, where we gathered about 100 faith-based justice leaders working on all sorts of issues, around the country, on poverty, on racial justice, on religious diversity issues. And we were trying to discern together how we can build a more effective movement for change. I have to say, I remember sitting there almost, you know, weeping at the beauty of what I saw, because we were young and old. We were Christians, Jews, and Muslims, and Sikhs, and humanists. And, you know, I would say it was, for me, the picture of the beloved community. Mm-hmm. And there was Simran, a Sikh American, you know, with his turban, who led a morning prayer. And a young Muslim woman activist, Drost, who does door-to-door organizing as a Muslim young woman, a millennial, in Nashville. And Rudy Rasmus, an African-American leader of a mega church in Houston in a very poor neighborhood. And then, you know, Stosh Cutler from Bend the Arc, who's a Jewish activist here in New York City, who asked the burning question, you know, what difference does faith make in our movements for social change? And so, for me, it was a picture of the world as we know it can be.
Those are good memories, and I'm glad you called the names, because the people there were important individually and brought together a strong community. I remember not long ago talking with Bishop Spong, and he said that it wasn't his preference to talk about progressive religion. He used the terms open religion and closed religion. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that, just as you said earlier, it's in the doing, maybe, and not so much the language. I think that what the word that I would use is an inclusive movement and a multi-faith movement for justice. And when we say inclusive, what I mean is multi-faith. In other words, people of different religious traditions working together. Mm-hmm. It means generationally inclusive. That includes seasoned leaders and emerging leaders, millennial leaders. It includes Republicans and Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the most important thing is that we're trying to get away from the divides that exclude people, that tell people that they are not a part of something. We see around us, particularly, you know, I think the sort of tragedy that we see in Washington, where the political divides in Congress and otherwise have really brought us to a standstill and call into question our democracy and call into question the premise on which America was built, namely for diversity. So I think that my word would be inclusive. We're trying to create welcome and inclusion.
Well said. Catherine, I mentioned in the introduction those words that you all use in describing your mission, trouble the waters and heal the world. And I often think when I read those, I love them, that that some people see that as two missions, and one group's troubling the waters and the others healing the world. And you all have brought them together.
We love it, too. We love our tagline, and it has traveled well around the country and the world, and a lot of people resonate with it. So, yes, we're putting two things together. It comes from the spiritual, wade in the water, children, God's going to trouble the waters. And I think our understanding of that is that all of us have to be involved in doing some of the troubling. In other words, you know, God can use our help as God's agents on earth, and that it sometimes takes some stirring things up to make change. Being passive or sitting idly by is not going to enact the change that we need and the change that we need to be. So that's where it comes from.
I love it.
And I particularly see the robust presence of millennials today who are helping to lead multi-faith movements for justice. And they are doing a lot of the troubling, and that is very heartening, because we need new generations who understand the world differently, who have a more inclusive experience and understanding of the new America that's multiracial, multi-faith, multi-gender, and so they are bringing a robust presence to this work.
When you talked about progressive religion, when you talked about the mountaintop gathering, you spoke in very positive and exciting terms. I think we all felt, for example, coming away from the experience at Mountaintop, a new kind of enthusiasm and optimism of what could be done, the new people that are involved. What to you, Catherine Henderson, is the most exciting part of this new work we're doing?
It's partly what I just said, which is that there is a new generation of millennials who are taking up this work, and that they are much less divided and much less exercised around the traditional divides of issues and race, for example, same-sex marriage, sexual orientation, that perhaps they can transcend some of the rhetoric and the political divides and religious divides that have really been obstacles for us in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that. I think we saw that at Mountaintop in Nashville back in June, that kind of leadership. And I'm aware of a number of gatherings of millennials around the country. And so for me, that is really different. I think, too, Welton, you and I grew up and were you more than I, but a part of the civil rights movement. And that, to a large extent, was a Christian movement. It was a different time. There were certainly Jews involved and others, but it was a very different time in this country. And so I think the other new thing that I'm seeing and heartened by is that, you know, minority religions, Muslims, Sikhs, and others who are finding their place and way as a part of this new emerging America. And they're part of this religious diversity, too, that America was really made to protect and uphold and support. This multi-faith presence, that is, it's very exciting. It's not always easy, but it's very exciting. And then the millennial presence as well.
And I would add, just from my perspective, the people with whom I get to work, people like you, make this a very fulfilling and mutually encouraging movement. And I'm grateful for that. And I tell you, Catherine, I think one of the things about Auburn and you personally and your leadership of Auburn that just strikes me as so important is the explicit, not implicit, but the explicit relationship between theological education and social justice. Social justice is not just something that people at Auburn study about. It's something they do. And say just a word about how important formal theological education is in this.
You are right that we are trying to draw these two things together. And you're right, just as the troubling the waters healing the world we're trying to pull together, we are trying to create the space in the world of theological education through modeling this at Auburn, the relationship to social justice. And, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. said something really great about the intimate connection of the two, that social justice without deep theological thought was mere enthusiasm, and that each relates to the other in a very important way. And so our work is trying to lift up that connection. And I think that we have identified capacities that we think that leaders need, the faith leaders who work on justice. Bridging divides would be one. Being courageous in the face of conflict. You know, how do you deal with the conflicts within your own movement as well as the ones out of it in terms of working on issues? Being wise about money, that's another one. And media savvy, you know, knowing how to use the media. These are some of the capacities. So religious leaders need different kind of capacities, and they need to learn them not in the classroom necessarily, but out there doing the work in the world.
Yeah. Just so we can answer the question that some people are going to be asking is, what do I do to be a part of this, or how can I find out more about this? Give them the website.
Great, great. Well, let me give you the Groundswell website first, www.groundswell-movement.org, and then www.auburnseminary.org.
Okay. I encourage our listeners to go there because
Please.
There's a lot of information.
Wonderful.
The Reverend Dr. Catherine Henderson is president of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. The seminary is a wellspring of innovative thinking, education, and activism. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to work closely with the people making that happen, and none of them more so than the president. Catherine, it's always good to be with you, and I thank you for what you do, and I thank you for taking time today to be on State of Belief Radio.
Welton, thank you so much. It's a privilege and great to be with you always.
This week, Religion News Service reported on one very practical response to Pope Francis's call for a deeper engagement with members of the church he leads. The organization, Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good, has posted an online narrative survey soliciting responses on key issues for the Catholic Church, with the promise that responses will be forwarded both to the Council of American Bishops and to the Vatican. In the very first few days, the response has been substantial, and I'm pleased to be joined by Christopher Hale, a senior fellow at CACG. Chris, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Reverend, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate being able to speak with you and your listeners today.
Were you surprised at the Pope saying he wanted to hear from people in parishes all across the world?
Look, you know, Pope Francis has been the leader of the Catholic Church for 7 months now, and every day is a surprise. So I think it's only a surprise when we wake up and read the newspaper, and there isn't a surprise there. So this is not a huge surprise. I think this really is the pastoral leadership he plans to take in moving the bishops forward and the church forward. So I think this fits right in line with really the vision that he's articulated in his first 7 months of being a supreme pontiff for the church.
Right. Tell us about Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good.
For sure. Well, our organization was formed in 2005. We have the goal of articulating the fullness of Catholic social teaching in the public sphere. We do that through via social communication, traditional media like we're doing today. And also we educate the laity and also members of the hierarchy as well on the fullness of the social teaching. So it's a mix of experts and laypersons, rank and file Catholics. Our membership is about 35,000 throughout the United States. But we've also really seen a jolt of the organization in the past 7 months. We really are a Pope Francis organization. He's really been the lifeline that really has spurred our movement forward.
What made you think that it was important to make this direct appeal for personal stories and to focus on what the Pope is doing rather than some of the other places you've been working?
So I think that these issues matter to people. Like, you know, I have a chance to worship every Sunday, and it's really incredible to see how much faith affects daily life for human beings. You know, my background's in politics, but there's points in people's lives where politics cannot touch. You know, politics can't be salvific. In fact, if it tries to be salvific, it becomes demonic in a way. So there are points that only faith alone can touch, and I think Pope Francis has clearly inspired the church, and he inspired me personally to really get into this work. You know, look, I quit a job because I believe in Pope Francis, and I believe in this organization. It affected me personally, and I can see it, not just in me, but like in my friends and family and all throughout the church, and even people who aren't Catholic or aren't Christian. This man is having an effect on the entire world, and you're seeing that. People are making decisions based on his papacy.
What kind of questions are you asking in the survey, if you could give us some examples?
For sure. Well, Pope Francis, when he directed this survey, he was looking for experiences. This is not a poll on people's doctrinal views. This is a poll on people's experiences. And so Pope Francis really wants to see what people are experiencing in the pews. So we asked four questions. First question we asked is on the church's ability to proclaim well It's teaching on married life and to support marriages. It's really important. You can talk about the fruits of marriage from the pew, but you need to help people who are going through marriages. So the question was, how are we supporting marriages in the Catholic Church? Second question we asked is, how are we supporting members of our community who are divorced and separated? The Catholic teaching on divorce is that it's not allowed within the church tradition. There isn't room for divorce. Our faith tradition's upheld for two millennia. However, we need to figure out a way to make space for people who have suffered divorce. You know, look, Catholic Church, about 1 in 3 Catholics are divorced, and secular society at large, it's 1 in 2. So this is a big part of our flock. How are we reaching out to these persons? Third question we asked is, how are we reaching out to same-sex couples and gay and lesbian members of our church? Are we making room for them to practice their faith tradition in our communities? And the last question, I think the one that we got the most profound responses to, was Pope Francis has articulated again and again that he wants this to be a church of mercy and a place of welcome. So we asked, what can the bishops do? What can the Pope do? What can we, the entire church, do in the context of marriage and family life, be a place of mercy and a space of welcome in our communities? So these are the four questions we asked, and the responses were as varied as the church, but really insightful and quite honestly very moving for me personally to read.
You have already, I understand, had a couple of thousand responses. Is it possible you could share a couple of stories that have come in so far?
For sure. I think the several themes have come out of the 2,200 responses that we've gotten. The biggest theme is, I think people in this church tradition or were in the faith tradition of the Catholic Church, so many of them want to be a part of this church. You know, they want a home in the Catholic Church, especially many people who are raised Catholic but no longer find a home there. I'll tell you three stories that I think kind of articulate the fullness of the survey. First story is from a woman from Chicago. She told the experience of her children going away for college, and she and her husband are sitting at home one day, and they realize, you know, they don't have the same feelings they had for each other when they first got married. They weren't, quote, in love anymore. And so she went to her parish priest. They both went to their parish priest, and he opened his arms and opened the resources of the parish, gave them access to prayer resources, but also to counseling, lay counseling. And so through prayer, through resources of his parish, through lay counseling, this couple was able to reconcile their marriage. Second story is another married couple. This woman was from Oklahoma. She told the experience that the church really prepared her for the wedding day. Really, that's really important. The Catholic Church requires intensive preparation for the wedding day for members who get married in the church. But she went through what she called a sophomore slump in the marriage. The feelings weren't there. The day-to-day life got difficult. And she didn't find the resources in the Catholic Church for her. She actually went to an evangelical community across the street who provided her those resources, those support groups, et cetera. So different experiences here and how people were supported in that, in their life. And the third story is a gay man from Boston. He came out as a gay man in the early 90s, about 20 years ago, after college. He came out, and he came to the conclusion that he needed to come out and tell his friends and family. And he told his parish priest, who was a good friend of his, a good friend of the family, and basically didn't get the response he was looking for. The priest told him, from what he experienced, that essentially, if he did not change, God's love was withdrawn from him. So this is not the God that the Catholic Church teaches about, the God who loves us regardless of who we are. So this man, this priest said, you know, I want to repeat what he said. He said, if you do not change, God will withdraw his love from you. So, I mean, this profoundly hurt this person. This is a faithful man. So he left the church for some time. And you can imagine, a priest, a friend says that to you, it affects you. But a few years later, he was able to find a parish, a priest, a community that was willing to walk with him on the way, in the journey. That priest, that parish, that community, that is the vision of Pope Francis. He wants a church that accompanies everyone on their way, on the journey of faith. And I think, so these stories kind of articulate well, I think, the experiences we've been reading again and again.
You might be interested to know that as a Baptist pastor who still has a congregation, just a few weeks ago, I did a sermon entitled Brother Francis and talked about how we all should be grateful for this man being in the Vatican. I want to ask you a similar kind of question before we go, and that is, just personally, when did you know this is a different kind of pope? This is a pope that understands my world and the problems in it. And what did that do to you?
For sure. Well, I think we should step back even a month before he got elected, the Holy Father, Pope Benedict. Think about this for a second. Pope Benedict, in a world that is obsessed with power, with ego, with individual, he said, I renounce this power. I renounce it. He said to the church, said to me, Christopher, church, I choose you over me. So I think in that act alone, you're starting to see the Franciscan vision, if you will. When Pope Francis appeared in the loggia of St. Peter's, he comes out in a simple white vestment. He decided not to use Mozzetta and the stole. He comes out as he is, and he greets the people in simple language. Good evening, brothers and sisters, he said, good evening. But I think what struck me the most of that night was not his simple language. He asked for prayers for him. He said, before I give the benediction, which is the blessing, I'm going to ask you to pray for me. And not just pray for me, pray in silence. In this world that we live in that is obsessed with noise, obsessed with moving from thing to thing, obsessed with superficiality, if you will, he got the whole world. A lot of people say this is the most watched television event in history. He got the whole world to be quiet for a moment, and I hope, pray. So I think he's calling us. From the beginning, we knew he was different. We knew that he was that this was not a this was not one of many. This was altogether different in kind. And I think those things, prayer, simplicity, withdrawing from the obsessive materialism of the world, it's something that we saw from the beginning. He rejects the apostolic palace. He lives in a hotel room, you know? So there's, I think from his election on March 13th, you knew the world had changed.
Yeah. I think that's the very well said. And I have great respect for the man, and I have great respect for you and what you're doing, and I wish you well. Christopher Hale is a senior fellow at Catholics in Alliance for the Common Good. If you want to see the papal survey, you can find it on online narrative survey. Here's the website, papalsurvey.com. Chris, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. We appreciate it. Hope to talk with you again.
Thank you so much. Keep pursuing your prayers, and we will do the same.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to support this show. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 800-856-0277. As always, we encourage you to tell others about this show. We want more people joining this conversation. Join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.